The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I was thinking about this as I was showing up. I'm interviewing winemaker Matt Smith. And Matt, if I did like 6 degrees of separation with my podcast, the amount of people that you are either directly connected with, have worked with in the past, have been mentored by, like you are all over the place. And I'm just thrilled to have you on the pod because you've done incredible work and I appreciate you taking time to join me today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, a ton to get into here. Let's first start with in a very different spot. You broke your arm. Was that a wine-related injury? I've never done wine-related injuries before, but I heard a tale, and I was wondering if you could tell it.
Yeah, I made a silly fall. I ended up shattering my elbow, had surgery the whole bit. So that put me out for a little bit, but now that the weather is getting warmer, I'm more concerned about my golf game. The arm is pretty well healed now and just getting strength back. But yeah, it was a silly wine mistake. Stuff happens.
Well, I mean, it's something that doesn't really get talked about. Usually it's you have to be careful when you're stirring the giant barrels that you can pass out and drown, and you hear those stories. But your job, it is a very physical one, isn't it?
Yep. Whether it's moving barrels around or climbing racks sometimes to pull samples from barrels. Yeah, it is. I don't think people quite understand how physical it actually can be. So yeah, on a daily basis, we can be, like I said, moving barrels around with a pump cart, climbing. Yeah, it can be pretty physical.
So let's go back to actually your bio. I just said winemaker, and people are listening going, well, who does he make wine for? I mean, a lot here in the Niagara Bench area. I just wonder if you just tell people who right now you're plying your trade with.
Yeah, sure. So I'm full-time here at Clousy Cellars.
Which is where we are right now. I should have said that.
Yeah, so we're in Vineland. And then I'm also the winemaker for Hansberger Estate, which is located in Jordan, which is where I live. On the Hansberger property, it's my in-laws' winery, and I also make wine for Kirby Estates, which is located in Iron Lake, and a few other small virtual places as well.
What's interesting is this must be great for you in that you get to work with two very different areas. You mentioned Hansberger, which is Jordan, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, and here us in Cloudsley Cellars, say we're not that far, 20-mile bench, sub-wine region here in Niagara. But then you also do Kirby,
yeah,
which is much more Merlot, Niagara on the Lake,
yep,
warmer climate. I mean, it must be just mentally stimulating to be just working in different, even though it's not that far, still working in different climates.
Well, it is. It's really cool because even from here in Vineland at Cloudsley, we have a weather station, and up the road from Hansberger, there's a weather station. And even between those two places, and as the crow flies, I think it's around 5 kilometers. The weather is so drastically different, and that's just between those two. And then you go to Niagara Lake, where it's generally much warmer at Kirby. So it's really nice because you can sort of make wine in a bunch of different styles depending on the terroir that you're making it from. So I have a lot of fun in creating those wines from all these different places.
And we'll get into them, but we'll get back to you for a second. In doing the research, you know, the bios that are available of you, one said you started your wine journey at 13. The hell did you start your wine journey at 13? This reminds me, Eddie Murphy started doing stand-up at like 15 or 16 years old. So how did you start that young?
Well, that's a good question. I actually owe it a lot to my mom's best friend, Janine. She got me into the wine world sort of by accident. I cut her grass, which is across the street from 30 Bench, and I was supposed to go to 30 Bench and cut the grass, and I never cut it once. And just started slowly helping in production, labeling, and then all the way to when I got older, doing tastings and working in the cellar and all that sort of stuff. So it just kind of gradually progressed into a love of wine.
This is such a nerdy wine joke I just thought of. Did you not cut the lawn at 30 Bench because you were favoring cover crops and wanting to do that for them?
Yeah, not at all.
Okay, that's right. Trust me, I hate myself for that joke. So for you, then, it was just part of your environment, wine, Niagara. For you, you fell into this very, very naturally.
Yeah, kind of. Like, it's really kind of full circle because, yes, I sort of fell into that, but my grandfather worked for the experimental farm in Vineland. So he brought in a lot of grapes, different varieties from France, and then sold them to the experimental farms. So at one point, he had a farm in Beamsville on Hickson Street, and they had over 100 different varieties of grapes. He had like one or two rows of everything and was just trying. And he's now long past, but my grandma's still around, but she was more on the orchard side, so she doesn't remember any of that sort of stuff. But he was a wealth of knowledge when I was slowly kind of getting into it. He was talking about how he's grafting in the ice box, which was really, really cool. So, I mean, there's a bit of it in my blood as well from grandpa, you know, but I mean, grew up in this area, lived in Beamsville, and then moved as far away as Jordan. So it's I've been here my whole life.
How good are the wine selection, the quality of wine at your family or your father and mother-in-law's during Christmas or Thanksgiving or a birthday or an anniversary?
Oh, it's great. My father-in-law is Italian, so we're pretty Italian heavy on the wines. I mean, they have wines from all over, but I also am a big fan of basically all Italian wines. So it's usually a pretty good selection.
What message would you give to people? And none of this are in the questions I had. What message would you give to people that are focused mostly on Italian wines and they're hesitant about Niagara satiating their bigger red wine needs?
I just think you need to have an open mind. I think most people sort of start somewhere and then sort of progress as they sort of mature in the wine world. And I think that's sort of really helped us, especially recently with the U.S. wines not being available at the LCBO. We've got now a ton of people that are like, I'm never going back, which is great for us to hear. But I just think you just need to have an open mind, try, be creative, you know, just try different stuff. Don't be afraid to, because there's different styles, like Niagara, like we were just talking about earlier. You get much warmer, generally richer wines in Niagara Lake. But then if you like sort of more mineral-driven wines, you come on this side of the bench. And just be open-minded and try new stuff.
Yeah, for instance, the Kirby Merlot, I think, certainly would scratch the itch for people who can't get their California Bordeaux blends.
Yeah, 100%. Those are generally riper style, made especially in the 2020 vintage. You know, generally higher alcohol, 14%+. So if you want bigger, richer style, those would perfectly land. And same with some of the Cab Francs we make at Hansberger as well.
I want to ask you about Hansberger. It's if I think about all the vineyards in Niagara, I know most of them just because of what I do.
Sure.
What do people need to know about Hansberger? Because I recognize when I was just getting ready for this interview, I know almost nothing about them. I know the name. I know you're connected with it, but I don't really know their style, their portfolio, or their story.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the coolest things about Hansberger is that it was a wash basin, like where the, not iceberg, but the glacial drift went out. So it is very sandy and rocky soils there. So we have very sort of gravelly, graphite-y Cabernet Francs, which I absolutely love. And they do super well in the soils at Hansberger. And same with our Riesling, very sort of rich, like kind of on the side of like the Rhine, right? Like where there's like very gravelly, rocky sort of soils. So those varieties do really, really well there. And we have such a high water table generally throughout the year that we don't have to really worry too much about drought stress, which is generally one of the things you have to worry about with super sandy and rocky soils. So it's a really unique site in that aspect. So those wines are always been, you know, sort of our staples is the Cab Franc and the Riesling, which we grow on site. And then also our Cab Franc Rosé, which is great on the patio with the wood-fired pizzas and that.
Okay, so that would be the thrust, would be those two varietals.
Yeah.
Would be the tip of the spear for you guys.
Generally, yeah. I mean, we also make, we have the Handshake series as well, which we get from one of our friends, Lincoln Lakeshore, Martin Schulz Vineyard, super old site. I get some of his quote-unquote young vine Sauvignon Blanc, which is like 35-plus-year-old vines. He's got an older block, which is a couple, like 3 years older, and then his old-vine Chardonnay as well. So those are the only spots where we get our other grapes from. It's the rest of it's grown on site.
The rise of Cab Franc seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, it seems to be more something over the last 10 years. And I wonder, is that the temperature is a little bit warmer, and not that Cab Franc needs Cabernet Sauvignon heat
right
to be able to properly express itself. Is it anything to do with climate change, or is it just to do with enough experimenting where winemakers and wine owners love the grape and finally figured out the best way to make it?
Yeah, you know what? For me, I absolutely love Cab Franc in this region from each end of the peninsula. I think we get it ripe every single year. Have we had some cold years where if it's too heavily cropped, it can be a little green pepper? Sure. But for me, I think, yes, the warmer region with, you know, global warming has helped. But I just think that it is so food friendly because it generally doesn't have as high tannins as Cab Sauv or something like that. It's just so versatile. I think that's why it does so well here. It's got great flavor, great fruit, and you can get it ripe. Mm-hmm. It just makes fantastic wines.
Think, and I'm trying to remember because I've been here for 2 weeks. I've done a bunch of interviews and I bought a bunch of wine. I think it was the 2019 Domaine K. Luce. They were pouring their Cab Franc, just drinking beautifully.
Yeah.
You know, 7 years of age on it, which isn't that long. It
no.
still has another 5 to 7 years. So that,
oh,
one,
yeah.
that one is really good. Okay, so you're not mowing lawns, but you're doing work at Cave Springs. How does it go from there when you, and maybe an easy answer because, again, it's in the family, but to make that decision to go to school, to want to become a winemaker, it's one thing to be interested yeah. in wine. It's another to say, that's going to be my life.
Well, I didn't do it right away. So I worked there from 13 to 21, I think. So it was 8 years. I actually went to school to be an industrial electrician. My first term, I actually ironically worked at Andrew Peller as an electrician for a summer. And then I went on to down the road at another place where we did robotics. So I did that for 8 years, but I traveled all over the place, all over the world. And I got tired of traveling. I was always gone. So I'm like, you know what? And it was a feast or famine industry. So at times when we had layoffs, I would start to go work with Kelly. She's the winemaker at Hansberger. Worked with her up at Domaine K. Luce as well. And I'm like, you know what? I really miss this industry. I'm like, I should really go back to school for this. My wife pushed me to go back to school. And then I'm like, you know, I just made the call and did it and went back after doing like a year with Kelly and then haven't looked back.
What is the impact of mentorship?
And
the two people that come up is you pick two of the best and two that have been on the pod more than anyone is Kelly Mason and Thomas Batchelder.
Yeah, they've been phenomenal. I've had a few really great ones. So I have Kelly and Thomas, Craig McDonald, Emma Garner. Like I've been super fortunate. Peter and Ann as well. Like I've had I've been really fortunate to have some really great mentors and it means everything. If you have great mentors, you can go a long way. I can call any of them at any time with any question and they'll give me an honest answer. Actually, we're pretty lucky on this side of the canal. Anyways, I can call any winemakers around here and we're all willing to help each other out to sort of all lift us up. So it's been really fortunate to have the mentors I've had.
I wonder, do you go to certain mentors for certain questions? Like you mentioned Peter and Ann, Peter Gamble and Ann Sperling. Do you go to Peter when you need Riesling help? Do you go to Thomas or, you know, when you need Gamay or Pinot help? Like, almost like you spin the wheel. All right, this is the issue. This is the person I need to go chat with.
Short answer, 100%. Yeah. Yeah. Cause they all have their talents and everything. They're all super talented. But yeah, of course, like if I have a specific question for something, I have someone in mind that I can go to.
So why does where we are, the 20 Mile Bench sub wine region is where we're sitting here in Niagara at Cloudsley Cellars. What is it about here that just works so well for Pinot and for Chard?
I think the relative distance from the lake and the soils, the famous term terroir. I think that this area, we are very fortunate with temperature. And ironically, major storms seem to just go circle around us. We don't generally get hit with these big storms. Like if it's a big, heavy hailstorm, Beamsville tends to get it. But it tends to miss us in Vineland on the 20 Mile Bench and then goes to St. Catharines. Jordan often gets missed as well. Major cold events were often warmer than, again, up on the escarpment or even, you know, Niagara Lake. And the soils here were very limestone rich. We have lots of groundwater here. Pinot and Chard just love that. They love the cooler temperatures. They love the minerality from the soils, the iron-rich soils we have here behind us in Park. It's just the soils and the climate here is just, I think, perfectly suited for those varieties.
How important was it for you, 2024, winning the Paul Pender Rising Star Award?
That was really cool. It came as a shock, honestly. I was talking to a buddy of mine that I went to school with, and I didn't even hear my name at first. And he looked at me, he's like, going up. I'm like, for what? I had no idea. So it was really, really cool. I was really, really honored to get that award. And actually, ironically, Allie messaged me today and she needs to pick it up for this week because mm-hmm. they're going to be handing it out to someone new coming up soon.
I was wondering if you'd tell people just a little bit about the legacy of Paul Pender.
Yeah, Paul was always helping people. He was just a wealth of knowledge, just as such a nice, kind person. you know, he made a really big influence impact in the wine world. He's made some fantastic wines at Taz and Redstone and that, and was always helping out wherever he could. So I think that award's fitting to have his name behind it.
And you can still feel the fingerprints of his wines.
Yeah.
And that Grand Cuvée or other events, sometimes they'll open some of his sparkling. And
absolutely.
And for people who don't know, tragically passed away a couple of years ago. And it's odd drinking one of his wines. It feels very emotional. You feel sad, and it just... all your emotions get heightened when you know that you're drinking something that he was a part of.
Yeah, it was one of the events we had at Thomas's. He did a bunch of stuff blind, as Thomas does, and we were supposed to sort of guess, you know, region. It was three different Pinots. I tell you, none of us were close. We all thought it was, one of them was Burgundian, one of them was from New Zealand, one of them was from all over, somewhere else, I can't remember. And they were all Taz 2015 wines that Paul had made. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, these wines were fantastic. Mm-hmm. And just drinking lovely. This was about, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, something like that. And it was right after he had passed. And so we were just sort of a tribute to him. And it was just amazing, the wines that he created.
We'll go to something a little more fun. I've talked about many times about Thomas Batchelder, that when you visit him, whatever amount of time you've booked, add a couple extra hours. What is the longest you ever spent with him at the Batcave where all his wines are?
That's a good question. A day. And, you know, if he tells you noon, you might as well show up at 2 p.m.
Yep.
Because he'll be late for his own funeral.
Mm-hmm.
Love him. But no, he's been fantastic. He's always learning something. He always has something he's trying to figure out and learn. And that's one of the best qualities Thomas has. He's always trying to, you know, especially with the terroir piece, he's always trying to figure out his sights and stuff. There's always something that he's trying to, you know, go back and forth on and try and learn something from. So yeah, one of the fun events was a Cuvée from the Heart we did with Elia from Leaning Post and Thomas and myself. And we, you know, it was supposed to be an hour tasting, and I think it was 8 that we ended up spending together. And trying to make the best wine, but we were trying to learn something afterwards too. So tasting through his barrels, but it was great.
Those spittoons must have been so full that emptied. And you're going to the bathroom so much because you're guzzling all this water. And
yeah.
And you helped with the Pinots, correct?
Yep.
I bid one a case of the Pinot.
So yeah, so we switched it up this year. So we did Chardonnay previously.
Yep.
And then this year we Ely and I were just like, can we do Pinot this year? Tom's like, yeah, sure, I'll switch, because he does both. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was a fun one to do. I thought it turned out great. We certainly had fun doing it. And, you know, here's a sort of like weird little side bit. When we were doing the blend, we did, I think, 16 blends when we were doing this blending session with Ilya and Thomas, and the first one was the one we chose, and we kept going back to it. It's like, we're like, holy crap, this one's really good. Well, we have to try other ones because the first one can't be the best one, and ended up being the best one after, you know, 2.5 hours of trying something different to reinvent the wheel, and we just stuck with the wheel.
Sometimes like looking for furniture, sometimes yep. The first bet is the best bet.
Yep.
That's Ilya Senchuk from Leaning Post. So how did you land here at Cloudsley?
Honestly, it was... So from working with Kelly and Thomas at Domaine Quilouze, I was invited to event Thomas was hosting at his house, and I met Adam, the owner of Cloudsley, there. And it was just through interactions with that. We're doing a blind tasting, and it was him and I in the finals. You know, we just kept chit-chatting. And then as I was going through school, he approached me, gave me a call, and met with him a few times and talked about what his goals and what the project was about. And I thought it was a fantastic idea and wanted to be a part of it. So he approached me from meeting him at Thomas's place.
I'm going to get to goals in a second, but I just thought of this. You've mentioned blind tastings a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have your best and worst moments of blind tasting where you nailed that this was a Pinot Nero from Northern Italy, or another time you called a Chianti a Bordeaux? Do you have shame and glory tales to tell?
Oh yeah, 100%. And if someone tells you they don't, they're lying. That's the best part about blind tasting. And it's ironic that you said Pinot Nero from one of the ones was a Chardonnay from Northern Italy. I think I forget exactly where it's from, but I absolutely nailed it. And then another one. I don't like all the ones that I've failed on. There's so many of them that there's not one that really sticks out, but there's a lot of them. There's definitely way more of the fail than there are the nailing. So
how did you call Northern Italian Chardonnay?
Because I had had one within the month, and I'm like, this, it was at a tasting, and I'm like, this really speaks Northern Italy. And then when I had a blind somewhere else, I'm like, this really reminds me of that time, because I had it sort of recently. And then when I nailed it, I was like, I knew it. I just had a wine from, I think it was even the same winery. So I think that really helped as well. But it was, just one of those ones where it's like, yep, this is exactly what I think it is.
Please tell me you trash talked everyone around you.
100%.
Okay, good. 100%. Oh my God. Thank God. I do the same thing. And yes, the failures are many more, but thankfully, maybe it's a good mindset to have. The victories stand out.
It's like golf.
Yeah,
you know, you don't get a birdie that often, but when you do, you got to let your buddies know.
Yeah, and then your wife is like, "I've heard this story. Okay, yeah. I get it. You're not a hero. You just got a 3 on a par 4."
Yeah.
What are the goals of Cloudsley?
We are looking and striving to make the best Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in not only Niagara, but the best we can make it. We're aiming high. We're really just trying to showcase this region and make the best wines we can.
What's the best vintage you've had? Because no one ever gets perfection.
Correct.
What's the closest where you're like, I don't know, I could have made that much. I don't know if I could have made that much better. And by you, of course, mean your entire team and Mother Nature, because every great winery is all low in intervention. But what's the one vintage like, yeah, we really nailed this?
So this one's it's a bit weird, but like 2020. So everyone's like, oh, 2020, hot vintage, it's awesome. It's actually challenging for cooler varieties like Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. We were in the vineyard, you know, sometimes twice a day, but it was every single day during those picks. And I think I nailed those pick dates for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. I think we made some of the best wines in 2020. It helped that it was dry and there was very low disease pressure, but to maintain freshness, you know, and fruit, not have a booze bomb was, you know, that was, I'm like, I absolutely nailed these pick dates. And I think that's one of the single most things you can control when you're making wine is your pick date and how ripe you can get your grapes. So I think that was super important. And you know, we got some really high scores in Decanter in that year for some of our Pinots. So I think that 2020 was the year that we did some really amazing things. And same with Kirby. And I wasn't with Hansberger then yet, but for Kirby as well, we made some fantastic wines in 2020.
Yep, I got a bunch of their Merlot sitting away somewhere. Actually, it's funny, you mentioned Decanter, because at one point, I was going to have the uncomfortable conversation of cost. Mm-hmm. How do you explain to people why they should be spending over 50, over 60, some of your top ones, you know, $100 for a bottle of wine, where that's more normalized in other regions of the world? And I imagine getting the praise from Decanter helps to knock down some of the barriers of people, local Canadians, Torontonians, being nervous about spending that money on a bottle of wine from a local vineyard.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a challenge for sure. But as Canadians, we're way too modest. It's like, for instance, if you explain it kind of like this, like these are our best barrels or our best blends. Generally, our top wines are around 4 barrels for argument's sake. And we think that this best showcase the vineyard in that vintage. And we don't make these every single year. Every vineyard that we source grapes from, we don't make single vineyards every single year from each site. We only do it where we think the quality is there. So this is our top quality that we have. You know, we're not trying to force people to pay these prices, but if you like them and you want them, because it costs a lot of money to do that. We hand pick, hand sort. We're very hands-on and meticulous with our sorting and our winemaking. But if you go to other places in the world, like you were saying, their top wines are $1,000, $2,000, whatever, and ours are $50 to $70. It's like, it's a discount. You know, some entry-level Burgundy stuff is like $30, $40. Well, we're getting close to our best stuff there. And so if you do a cost comparison, it's like these wines are completely outperforming the entry-level Burgundy stuff.
I have noticed at the LCBO, a lot of the Burgundies now, the simple Bourgognes that used to be the, okay, $22 are now like $33, $35.
Yep.
And you're kind of staring at it a little bit screwy.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's, All right, bouncing from there, making Pinot Blanc for Kirby Estate.
Yeah.
What do people need to know about Pinot Blanc?
Pinot Blanc was an interesting one. I haven't made it before, so
that must have been fun.
Yeah, so we did a tasting of different Pinot Blancs, and I sort of landed where I was going to make it similar to Chardonnay. I have a lot of experience with Chardonnay. I wanted it barrel-aged and fermented, not for 18 months like our Chardonnay. Just wanted to tamp the fruit down just a bit on lees and that to have a little bit of creaminess. I think it really did a phenomenal job in barrel. I didn't want it super fresh and sort of steely. I wanted it a little creamy, and I wanted the aromatics to come out with the barrel fermented. So we made another one this year as well, and I think it turned out really well. So the first one, I think, was about 7-ish months in barrel, and this one's about 5, so slightly less. And it's just a stylistic choice. They're sort of showcasing similar qualities. But I think it really grows well here. It's, you know, part of the Pinot family, has tight bunches. And, you know, if you don't farm it properly, it'll rot on you like any Pinot does. So it's, you know, the Wismers farm it, and they do a fantastic job. And I think we make great wine from it.
What are the characteristics of it? Someone's like, I haven't had a Pinot Blanc. How would you describe it?
Again, it's kind of similar-ish to Chardonnay. There's a bit more sort of melon fruit component to the Pinot Blanc with, like I said, a bit of that creaminess and a little bit of cantaloupe. So a little bit more of the sort of riper-ish flavors that I was getting from their site. It's planted on a bit of a... Some of their plantings are east, west, and north-south. I can't remember exactly which...
Yeah.
Part, I think that one is east west. God will kill me if I if he hears this, and because I can't remember which one it is. So it is shaded a bit, and we maintain a lot more of the acidity in that from that, because it's quite warm down there. So,
and I always tell people, if you're looking to branch out, you love Chardonnay and you want to dip your toe but you don't want to go too far away, then Pinot Blanc is a good sort of good safe port for someone to go into. Totally off wine topics for a second. I've been here for 2 weeks and the weather has sucked.
Oh yeah.
It's cold every day. It's rainy all the time. I went on your Instagram account. How you doing training for the 50K run and all this crap weather?
Well, I'm not doing the 50K this year. I'm just doing the 20 because okay. I had to cancel because of my arm.
Oh, because of broken arm. Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry. I didn't know that. Yeah.
So it's, it's not, this is going to sound weird. I was almost a bit relieved when I broke my arm because I'm like, training in the winter sucked too, because I was training at that time for the 50K. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. The rain, it honestly doesn't bother me running. Once you're running and you're warm, it's fine. It's more, I've been more nervous about the vineyard. I walk the dogs every morning and night around the farm, and I'm just like, we have a wind machine at Hansberg as well, so we're always sort of checking it and making sure our temperatures are set on it and making sure it's running and all that sort of stuff. So, but, you know, knock on wood, I don't think we got any frost damage, and it was close the other night or the other morning, I think 2 mornings ago.
Two mornings ago, there was frost on my on the window of my car, and where I'm staying is literally across the street from Henry Appellum.
Yeah.
And I heard the fans going everywhere.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it only got, I don't know what it was, the temperature there, but at home it was about 1 degree. So ours was set to 1.4, which is just a safe measure. You know, no damage was seen. So, but yeah, they were... It sounds like a helicopter's over top of the house. They're not exactly quiet. Yeah.
I feel like this next question is like Fred Willard asking questions in Best in Show. But do you ever do a light jog through the vineyards? Because I remember talking to Kelly Mason about, you know, the steps she get, you know, the amount of steps on her watch, you know, when you're checking and going through all the vines. You can get a pretty decent cardio workout.
You sure? Yeah, but I wear steel toes, so it's they're a little heavy to be running in. Yeah. So. But no, I like I said, I walk the dogs all the time in the vineyard, and they love it.
Yeah.
So I mean, as a dog would, but no. Yeah.
If you ever get reincarnated as a dog, vineyard dog is the best of all the dogs. You've mentioned the word terroir. People, what is your relationship with your word with that word and the concept of it? Because it can be polarizing. Some people love it. Some people overuse it. Some say it doesn't mean shit.
Yeah.
I'm curious your take on it.
So yeah, I look at it a pretty simple mindset. It's literally the place, and what I mean by that is what your weather is, what your soil is, what the vine's doing there, or what your block is doing or there. Because I mean, you can have different sort of performing areas in different blocks, even within the same vineyard. I'm a bit of a soils geek. Like, I look at the map all the time, and then I sort of argue back and forth with other winemakers. Not argue, we have this constructive conversation about appellations, because there's definitely a divide on the 12, or not the 12, like where the harbor is, like the divide between Jordan and Vineland. Mm-hmm. The further east you go, the soils are different than on the bench than they what they are here. So I look at that, and I look at what the, and even like when I was referring to at Hansberger, that was the further south you go, the rocks get bigger and bigger and bigger, and the further north you go, the rocks are finer and more gravelly. So this is kind of jumbled all over the place,
it's okay.
But it's, and then what the weather does there. So I really just look at, okay, what is my site doing? What am I getting from the site? And especially when it comes to planting, because I've done a bunch of plantings now at Hansberger, and we're planting again. And it's like, what do I think will, whether it's with rootstock and plant material, what do I think is going to work well here with the conditions, weather and soils that I have? So, and then again, with the native yeast, because I'm mostly a wild ferment winemaker, you know, sort of mostly hands off. If we grow the best grapes that we can, I shouldn't have to intervene too much. If we, you know, if we do the, you know, grow the grapes the right way. So it's whatever the site is sort of giving me the flavors that I'm getting from it. Like from year to year, we're getting similar flavor profiles from the same vineyard. So, and I can have one that's like, for instance, we have Park and Hank that are literally, you know, 20 meters apart, and they are completely different from each other. And that's just sort of where they are located on, like, you know, that's what their terroir is. Like, that's what the ground, the soils and everything is giving, compared to Park. It's just like,
by the way, sorry to interrupt, it's wild. Like, I think it's so important for people to realize that, you know, like, oh, Burgundy, if you're here, if you're 100 meters, it's going to be different. And some people think that that area's got a monopoly on it. But you mentioned Park, Wismar Park Vineyard, yeah, and Hank Vineyard. Both of them, we can see them if we popped our head out the window there. Yeah. And they are incredibly close to each other. And yet they can produce different styles. It's a wild thing.
It really is. And it's, I mean, there's different clones in that too, which is a whole nother topic, but it's, but yeah, like it really is, interesting what each block is going to do. Like every site is different.
Yeah.
And I think that's the cool spot.
Oh, here, we'll just grab the phone real quick and this is easy to edit in and out. By the way, look at that. You know, a home line, a landline. You don't see landlines. I guess you do when you're still a business, because you still people come for tastings,
yeah,
and they purchase wine, so there's more of a chance of a landline. But yeah, look at that.
They're around, not a lot, but they're still kicking around.
Yeah. So again, just to finish up, obviously different clones have a different impact.
Yep.
But being, you know, 200 meters apart also can have such an impact.
Yeah,
as well.
And even like, so for instance, like our, like I was just describing with our Riesling block at Hansberger, even like, and I've also done this at Foxtrot Chardonnay, I've picked rows in sections, north, middle, and south, and they've been different. They perform differently because, you know, the furthest south part is on a bit of a hill. You know, in the middle is a bit of a valley, and then the further south part kind of raises up again, and it's more airflow there. So they all perform slightly different. And this is, you know, Thomas has sort of taught me that, and he's the king at talking about terroir. But yeah, it all makes a difference. Every, like, I could tell you exactly how to make a wine, and there's from this parcel, and you're not going to make the same thing. They're all just, it's all different. And I think that's sort of the, but we will get similar flavors because it's from that site. And because the same site, even though whether it's close or far, it's still going to produce similar flavors from year to year, whether it be hot or cold or rainy.
Are you looking forward to the day when you become the mentor? Maybe you already are, but when you start mentoring the next generation of winemaking, even though you're still, you know, way, way, ways from being the wise old winemaker, but are you looking forward to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like, it's that's kind of an interesting question, because it's like, how do you know when you are doing that, I suppose? Because like, we all have constructive conversations with other fellow winemakers. Some are older than me, some are younger than me. So I think we're kind of always doing it in a sense. But yeah, like, absolutely looking forward to it. I love helping people out where I can. Yeah, it's great. It's fantastic.
Matt, I really appreciate you being on the pod. I'm a big fan because I buy lots of wines from Kirby. I buy lots of wines from Cloudsley. I'm going to check out Hornsberger at some... Wait, did I say
Hornsberger?
Hornsberger, not Hornsberger. I'm an idiot. So no, I'm a fan of just so many different wines that you have played a part in. I'm glad your arm is better. Good luck on the golf season, which eventually will come. And appreciate you doing the pod today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on iTunes, Spotify, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.